This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Sego, Skanagowa. My name is Ben Paulus, as mentioned. I'm a member of the Wolf Clan of the Ganyakahaga, or Mohawk Nation. And first off, I want to start off by acknowledging and thanking our Chumash relatives for not only honoring us, but honoring all of us here and hosting us today in their territory. So as mentioned, I do work with a number of different groups: Indigenous Environmental Network, Defenders of Land. I do work with youth groups in Canada as well, and have worked at United Nations level for the past number of years with different Indigenous organizations from around the world. And so I'll be drawing a little bit from all of those different experiences, as well as a little bit from my own academic past, studying Indigenous peoples, climate change, and human rights at Carleton University in Canada. And I also wanted to briefly mention that my people, Mohawk, part of the Iroquois Confederacy, were also originally on the coast all the way up to New York State. Before there was a little incident, you guys probably studied, the American Revolution pushed our people up to Canada, north of the border, because we were allied with the British at the time, which was apparently a bad thing to do. So I apologize, I'm a little bit tired today. Climate change almost kept me from participating in this conference. I flew in from Ottawa via Toronto yesterday, and the entire northeast of North America got hit by just a freak combination of frozen ice pellets, freezing rain, snow, slush, and the combined wrath of the gods. And my first flight had to turn around. They couldn't even land in Toronto. We sat around for a few hours. I missed my connection, and I only got in about midnight last night here. So it's good to be here. So as mentioned, I'm going to be talking a bit about Indigenous peoples, trying to ground the experience of different Indigenous realities, and how Indigenous peoples are impacted by not just climate change itself and sea level rise, which we will talk about, but also the drivers of climate change, as well as impacted by what are being put forward as solutions to climate change, and trying to sort of build an understanding of how all those things come to overlap. So I'm going to focus the first part of my talk on two different experiences, two different places that I think really help to ground us, really help to demonstrate some of those realities. Also because, you know, they're some of the most extreme examples, but some of the most informative, some of the most illustrative places to look at. And can you advance the slide? Oh, this one, okay. The first place I'll be talking about is Bagua in the Peruvian Amazon. How many people have heard of Bagua in this room? One, two. Well, what happened in Bagua was a result of a free trade agreement that the United States signed with Peru, which, you know, probably most people in this room are equally unaware of. Being so inconsequential for, you know, the United States, it meant everything to the lives of a number of Peruvians. I happened to be in Peru in 2009 when the free trade agreement was signed. At the time, there was a massive Indigenous gathering of about 4,000 people gathered in north of Peru. And just as I was supposed to leave, we learned about this incident going on in the north of Peru, in the Amazon, where a number of people had been killed in disputes in altercations between Indigenous Amazonian protesters and government forces. And it was a very, very unclear situation at the beginning, and I ended up getting almost stuck in the country. My flight got canceled out of the country, and so I ended up visiting and doing some work with some of the Indigenous organizations in the area who I had some contacts with as a result of that conference. And so I got in touch with them, and the initial days after the sort of incident happened were a very, very tumultuous time. We're very much time of widespread confusion and fear, because a lot of the indigenous communities were expecting the government to continue intervening in their communities. And a lot of the government had basically issued arrest warrants for a number of the indigenous leaders all across the country. And so a lot of us were very sort of concerned in those first few days, when, without really, you know, necessarily even knowing the full extent of what happened, because at the time as well, besides a few pictures I'm showing you, these are not my photos. The rest of them after these series of photos are all mine. After besides a few pictures that got leaked out, the entire media story, the entire, you know, narrative was very much controlled by the military and by the government at the time. And the president, you know, was using his power to go on, you know, national media and say that, you know, because of the terrorism, because of the extremism, because of the barbarity of these savages in the Amazon, they are trying to stop our progress. They attacked our people. They attacked our military. They attacked our, you know, forces. We had to go in and protect ourselves and protect, you know, Peruvian democracy, the Peruvian state. And, of course, we knew that, you know, that wasn't true. That wasn't the real narrative. And so with a little bit of support from NGOs and also from universities, I was asked to go down and with a delegation that included some chiefs, as well as other media representatives, to actually go and find out a little bit about, you know, what had actually happened in the area. And so we actually traveled down into the Amazon and spent about a week there trying to basically figure out, trying to reconstruct a little bit of what had actually occurred. And our task was made very difficult by the government, who had gone in the, you know, the days afterwards, after the incident, and basically sanitized the area. So where the actual conflict had taken place was maintained as a sort of completely cordoned off zone. The entire area was under military curfew. We had to stay, you know, a few towns over and travel in so that we wouldn't be affected by that curfew. When we arrived to, you know, the main community, which is a mix of an indigenous and non-indigenous community right on the sort of outskirts of the Amazon, you know, it was very hard to find anybody, actual witnesses who had been there, because what the government had done was also ship a lot of the indigenous villagers back to their communities, basically by force. The only ones who remained were either in jail or in the hospital. And so we did travel and we did meet and talk to them and begin to, you know, piece together a few bits of what had happened. And one of the most actually incredible things was a little bit of the solidarity. So I'll just go back to the last slide for a second. This was the police station in the town itself. This is one of the most sort of inspiring moments there. But when the non-indigenous villagers here had found out what was happening to their brothers and sisters, that they were under attack, you know, just outside of town at the protest site that they had set up, they actually rallied in the town and surrounded the police station and, you know, were very sort of angry at what the police were doing. And so this ended up becoming a second zone of conflict, as the police responded by getting up on top of their building and firing into the crowd, actually killing a number of people and injuring children in the area, anybody who happened to be sort of in the area. Very, very sort of extreme response. And this was the actual zone of the conflict. And so you can see actually large parts of it had actually been burnt down completely, making, you know, any sort of recovery of any evidence almost impossible. So we decided that to actually learn about what had happened, we had to go into the Amazon. We had to travel a little bit, visit some of the actual villages where people lived. And so we did that, and traveled as far as we could basically go by road. Most of the Amazonian communities are only accessible by boat, but there are a number that, you know, on the outskirts of the Amazon that can be reached by car, by transit. So we traveled to those communities and began, you know, talking to a lot of people who had participated in the protest. It was a massive protest that had actually occurred over a period of about 2 months, involving about 30,000 of the region's indigenous inhabitants, out of a total population of about 300,000 people in the area, so almost 10% of the entire population of the Amazon had partaken in this massive protest, which is a really incredible sort of sign and testament, especially because many of them came from villages of about 100 people. What emerged was really an idea of, a lot of the senseless violence, a lot of sort of betrayed promises by the government over, what had gone on, what had been negotiated between the indigenous groups and the government prior to the actual conflict itself. We found out from one of the leaders of the indigenous movement that, in fact, they had actually signed an agreement with a peace agreement with the government in the weeks that preceded the conflict, basically assuring each side that no violence would happen to either side. The government this whole time was claiming that the indigenous villagers were armed and dangerous. In fact, they had spears, but that hardly really equates to the government, which had tanks, helicopters, and machine guns in their possessions. And so what we learned was that the day before the actual conflict took place, the government, the military, had actually sat down and negotiated with the protesters who had been maintaining this protest and a blockade to take down the blockade for the period of a day and allow traffic to go in and out, and after which they'd be allowed to carry on with their protest. What instead happened was that military forces descended upon the protest site at about 6 a.m., just after dawn, and what we were told by the indigenous folks who were there was that the police began opening fire when they were confronted by the villagers who demanded to know what they were doing. And very soon afterwards, helicopters and armored tanks basically showed up to reinforce them and, push them back many kilometers from where they were doing, completely disrupting and ending the protest. And in the ensuing violence, as well as the violence that carried over into the neighboring city, or the neighboring town, over 30 people lost their lives, including a number of protesters, number of civilians, as well as a number of police. And so, of course, in the initial outset, there was widespread condemnation within the media, within, the government, the respectable sectors of, this violence against police by, the indigenous protesters before, we could actually get some of the story out there. But the other thing that we were really interested in was finding out from a lot of the Native community, what they had been protesting for, what they understood of this, free trade agreement. And I found it completely incredible that, a lot of these villagers have, I think, a much better sense of what's involved in these free trade agreements than probably most Americans, most Canadians, who, ostensibly these are signed on behalf of, because they knew that it would involve more oil extraction, more mining, more toxic waste, more deforestation, more poisoning of their rivers. And as if to prove that point, as we were leaving the Amazon area, we actually came across this oil spill that you're sort of seeing here, taking place live, and a village right adjacent to it, trying to find out what had happened, trying to get some answers, and the military came along and basically forced us out of the area and said that we couldn't be there, we couldn't be taking any pictures, we couldn't be interviewing people. Because for the Amazonian, tribes there, this was, and this kind of development, quote unquote development, represented the end of their food systems, the end of their sources of water, the end of their pharmacies, really, their education systems, their culture and their ways of life. And for us, it was a really profound understanding of how shallow and one-sided, this idea and this model of development really is and really was. And so from there, I want to jump ahead to a year later. Oh, sorry, there's a few more pictures here. One of the other sort of impacts that came out of this was actually a widespread condemnation eventually of the government by civil society after the real story began to get out, after the media began to pick up on what the protesters had been saying all along and what couldn't be hidden by the government anymore. There was the biggest protests against the Peruvian government since the end of the Fujimori dictatorship a number of years ago. And so they ended up kicking out the government and forcing the government to retract some of the laws that they had passed that were, you know, the most offensive to indigenous communities there. So there was a bit of a victory there from, you know, the side of the protesters and the you know, civil society actually coming and rallying around, you know, and supporting indigenous communities in Peru, where there's often been a very strong and very heavy divide amongst, you know, civil society groups there. And so, you know, a bit of a you know, positive story afterwards, but a lot of those communities are still struggling to this day to deal with the impacts and the effects. And of course, you know, mining, oil, forestry companies haven't stopped their foray into the Amazon there. So I want to go from there, travel from the Amazon up to northern Alberta, almost the exact opposite environment, where, you know, I'm pretty sure that most people are familiar with the development of the tar sands. But what you may not realize is that it's right now, at this point, it's one of the biggest development projects on the face of the planet, trying to develop the resources of the third biggest oil deposit on the globe. That's northern Alberta. It's one of the worst environmental hotspots in all of North America, and one of the ones that has, I think, the most impact of any sort of these developments around the planet, just in terms of its scale. Has anybody actually been up to see the tar sands at all? Nobody from here. One person. Yeah. And so you begin, it's only really once you're there that you begin to understand the scale of it, the fact that you can, if you're flying over it, you can fly for about 30, 40 minutes, even longer, and you begin just to cover the area that's been destroyed of, you know, the boreal forest, which is part of the biggest forest ecosystem on the entire planet. I participated in a photo documentary series that took place over a number of weeks between 2010 and 2011, visiting a number of different indigenous communities, trying to understand, you know, how some of them were being impacted. And one of the first communities I impacted, or I visited here, was Fort Mackay, which these pictures are from. And, you know, what actually looks like a lake is actually a pool of toxic chemicals, almost a mile wide and 3 miles long. In the backyard of one of the native communities there, who are often, you know, the ones that are you know, completely discounted. Most people don't even realize there's almost a dozen native communities that still live in this area, and they're the ones who are, you know, completely feeling the impact of this. What it really is an all-out war, an all-out assault on Mother Earth, that they're going through and tearing down, you know, this forest. They're polluting the rivers that were once some of the cleanest in North America, and replacing it with a toxic moonscape. This community in particular here has begun to, a lot of the hunters have begun to notice that their bodies are getting covered in rashes just from actually walking through regular the muskeg, the sort of bog. Boggy areas that they do a lot of their hunting, their fishing, their trapping still to this day. A lot of these communities are fairly remote, I might add, as well. And so a lot of people actually still depend on, to this day, hunting, trapping, fishing for a lot of their food sources, you know, especially fishing, especially a lot of moose in the area. And so, you know, one of the other things that people really tried to impress upon me when I was traveling there was that, you know, they used to be able to drink the water, you know, in their backyards in the Athabasca River, and it's gone from, you know, being able to do that about 30 years ago to that being one of the most polluted bodies of water, probably in North America at this point, where, you know, in this community in particular, Fort Mackay, which is surrounded by a number of these industrial plants, children are now being born with respiratory illnesses. Just in a really extreme situation. I spent a few days there, and, you know, I was already feeling nauseous. I was getting headaches. You sort of feel stuff in the back of your throat all the time. And, you know, community members are expected to live like that every day in and day out. Traveling a little bit farther north, we visited the community of Lubicon Cree, and they had actually been recently impacted by a gigantic oil spill, second biggest oil spill ever in Canadian history. About 1 million gallons had leaked into their backyards as well. And similar to a lot of the oil spills that we've been hearing about in the past few weeks, the community was only informed about these spills, three or four days after they had happened, after people had, you know, already begun to get sick. And then, you know, the company tried as best that they could to keep community members from actually seeing what had happened to their land. I just want to point out in this picture to really get an idea of the scale. I think there's a little laser here. Right there is a full-size pickup truck. So these trucks around here are the biggest trucks on the planet. If you've ever seen the movie Avatar, they're kind of on that scale, holding about 400 tons of earth in each one. And they operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, going and scraping down 100, 200, 300 feet of earth of what used to be, you know, pristine boreal forest. So this is you know, kind of what you see if you travel up to the area. This is what, you know, development of Earth's most extreme sort of forms of energy looks like up close. Traveling even farther north, we visit the community of Fort Chipewyan, and they become famous as one of the most impacted communities, even though they're actually very far removed. They're about 200 miles away from the actual developments. Their community lies along Lake Athabasca, the Athabasca River. And so, again, their community is one that's heavily dependent upon fishing and hunting and trapping. Being a fly-in community, there's no roads that go up to the community at all times. And right now, you know, what they're saying is that probably about 10% of the fish that they catch are deformed, have different growth spots on them, have red blotches, have, you know, different little pus-filled areas on them. Some of them, they say, they have tumors. About 10% of the fish at this point. And what they're saying is that in the future, they expect, you know, not to be able to eat or drink anything from the lake in about 10 years from now. And what this has meant for community members as well is that they're actually dealing with the impacts of multiple cancer clusters in the area. Very rare cancers have been found in the community at rates about, you know, 500% more than they should be, to the point where the average person living there has about a 30% chance of developing cancer over their lifetime. People as young as in their 20s are developing cancer these days. And this is a picture of a woman who survived double breast cancer and, you know, eventually decided that she had to move her family out of the community because she was too scared to raise her children and her grandchildren there and expose them to those pollutants, which should be a choice that none of us have to make, to abandon, you know, our community, to abandon our roots simply for, you know, the health of our children. This is a picture of the chief of the community. And, you know, he was really reticent about you know, becoming involved in politics, about becoming a chief. And what ended up pushing him into that was the fact that his nephew, who was only in his 20s, ended up getting cancer and passing away in the community, who was a cousin of this man here. And so, you know, for a community only of just over 1,000 people, every single family has been touched by, you know, these sort of tragedies. That, you know, this development, I should also mention, is only about 10 years old. It's only been in production for about the past 10 years in a very serious way. And so that, just as in the Amazon, you know, people are very much scared for their lives, very much concerned that, you know, the unprecedented rate of, you know, development is going to basically create and render their communities unlivable in the future. And so just as with the Amazon as well, people have begun to resist that. People have begun to stand up and speak up. And so this is a picture from what's called the Healing Walk, which is in its fourth year this year, a mixture of a protest as well as a prayer for Mother Earth that brings together a lot of these different communities who are, you know, spread out as far as, you know, 300-400 miles from each other. And they've, you know, begun to participate and, you know, share experiences after they realized that they were all dealing with some of the same impacts, even though they were, you know, so disconnected from each other. And the stand that these communities have made has inspired a lot of other communities to get involved, has inspired a lot of other communities to understand the impacts of the tar sands on those communities in Alberta, as well as push them to take action in their own territories to stop development of related infrastructure, including pipelines, especially pipelines that are going to go across British Columbia, one of the most pristine landscapes that we have, and cross over about 50 different native territories over there, as well as much more recently, we have the plans for pipelines going all the way across Canada to the east, another Enbridge pipeline, as well as, of course, the famous Keystone XL pipeline that is being sought to develop and push oil from tar sands down into the United States, to which there's been a tremendous amount of resistance, tremendous amount of activism over the past little while. And so that's really inspired a lot of people and a lot of movements, social movements in Canada, to begin to get involved, to begin to really, really take and understand this issue seriously, and also to understand it from an Indigenous rights perspective, as not just this sort of simple environmental problem, but as an environmental justice issue, as a moral issue, as a human rights issue as well. And so we've had a tremendous amount of support in the past little while, and also communities coming together from the United States and from Canada, trying to develop those linkages. And the other sort of efforts that it's really engendered have been a lot of legal strategies to try and stop and control the tar sands, relying on Indigenous rights and law, which are slightly differently applied in Canada than in the United States, but which in theory should allow for Indigenous communities to have a right to slow down or stop development in their territories. And so there's a number of really potentially powerful legal precedents that are going through the court right now that are testing the ability of those Indigenous communities' rights to say no. So those were two, informative, really descriptive examples of what we're talking about, the resource neocolonialism that's impacting Indigenous communities, not just in North America, not just in South America, but around the world, and are also prime factors in creating and causing climate change, and also make these communities a lot more susceptible to the impacts of climate change when it actually does come to their communities. I want to talk a bit about sea level rise. I'm not going to go super in depth because I know we have a lot of other speakers that are going to touch on some more technical aspects here. But I do want to preface, what I'm saying is. Talking about sea level rise, we have a lot of different ideas of what might happen in the future. Different forecasts from different authorities on the subject matter. The IPCC, famously reporting that potentially 1 foot of sea level rise, not taking into account the melting of Greenland or the Antarctic ocean or the Antarctic ice. To more recent and much sort of scarier predictions, including ones from James Hansen that say, we can expect anything from 2 to 5 meters of sea level rise within this century, which is within the time frame of people who are alive today. Following these examples and looking at the fact that pretty much no countries on the earth are really taking the issue of climate change seriously, it doesn't seem like we're in a place that we can neglect the extreme threat of sea level rise that it goes beyond 1 meter, 2 meters, and definitely potentially in the future dozens of meters if climate change is not controlled. We might not be talking this century, but these are things that we really should be thinking about and dealing with. And so as was mentioned by Roberta, we have a lot of Indigenous peoples that live in a lot of these different coastal environments around the world, and a lot of Indigenous peoples on this planet today tend to inhabit or have been forced into some of the most extreme environments that really exist on the planet, which also happen to be biological biodiversity hotspots on this planet. So within, you know, the areas that are inhabited by, you know, the 5% of the world's population that are represented by indigenous peoples, we have about 90% of the ethnic and cultural diversity and about 90% of the biodiversity on land represented in those areas. And so for indigenous peoples, their economies and their cultures are intimately intertwined with the biodiversity, the life that occurs in those areas. And I think, you know, one of the most telling is, you know, the situation of indigenous peoples living in island states and whose culture is dependent on those islands. And, you know, I understand we have some speakers there who are going to speak to that. But it bears mentioning that, you know, some of these islands are already beginning to subside to climate change. We have storm surges that are wiping away communities in these areas. Some islands and island states will disappear completely within this century. And, you know, some of that has already begun to happen. Others may have to be forced to relocate entirely. And, you know, what that really represents is really unfathomable. It's a loss of an ethnogeography. It's a loss of an ecosystem. It's a loss of an entire culture that's entwined in those places. For Arctic communities, which you're also going to hear about, sea level rise compounds with, you know, a decline in the sea, with the sea ice, that sort of threatens a perfect storm in many ways of coastal surges, coastal erosion that threatens to push many of these communities into the sea at this point. And then that gets compounded with the loss of permafrost, which, you know, causes some of these communities to be in complete disarray all around the Arctic. And so, you know, what we're having right now is that, you know, there's already communities in Alaska, but also other places in the world. Russia doesn't get a lot of mention because they don't actually have the resources to do this, but, you know, a lot of the indigenous Arctic communities in Russia are dealing with, you know, very much the same thing, but, you know, might be forced to live with entirely collapsing infrastructure for a number of years and might not have any sort of recourse at all. There's a number of other indigenous coastal communities that all face these challenges, and combined with the loss of marine ecosystems on which they depend for food and their economy, the loss of some ecosystems entirely, changes in salinization levels, the salinization of groundwater, destruction of a lot of mangrove ecosystems across the world, more powerful storms, more diseases coming into these communities, we have a lot of these different impacts of climate change all combining to threaten a lot of the world's indigenous peoples that happen to live in coastal areas, including communities all around the coast of the Americas. So these threats of climate change really represent a number of particularly amplified threats to indigenous peoples, including threats to their food security and sovereignty, as the animals and plants upon which many indigenous peoples rely lose their habitat or are forced to change habitats entirely. A real threat to water security as a threat of sea level rise causing salinization, the loss of culturally significant places, ceremonial sites, burial places, traditional medicine grounds, basically, you know, an irreplaceable amount of heritage potentially being lost forever, and the ability to preserve and continue to teach a number of traditions. A lot of, you know, our people's traditional knowledge is tied up in an understanding of the land, of the water, of, you know, the different environmental systems and how they function. And already a lot of that is being put into jeopardy by the inability to, you know, actually and correctly predict what the ecosystems will do, what the weather patterns will do, what the climate will do on a long-term scale. So these all culminate, I would argue, in a very serious threat to the, you know, human rights of indigenous peoples around the world, including the right to self-determination, which is, you know, sometimes seen as less tangible, but I think ultimately very, very important to the future and then preservation of indigenous cultures around the world by removing indigenous peoples from collectively being able to take action. Now, I want to contrast this, you know, portrayal of indigenous peoples and how they're impacted by climate change with the actual responses that indigenous peoples have been taking over the past number of years to climate change as an issue in the international fora. And so there are three different trends that I want to mention that were sort of brought up earlier. The responses by indigenous peoples two of the dominant politics and institutions that are dealing with climate change, the responses to what are often called the false solutions that are being implemented and enforced around climate change, and of course the responses to what are identified as the true drivers of climate change, of which we've seen a few examples already. So just to give by way of a brief history of Indigenous involvement, a lot of Indigenous involvement around the issue of climate change, as climate change began in 1992 with the first Rio Earth Summit, in which a number of Indigenous communities from around the world participated and had played a strong part in really pushing countries to take Indigenous communities very seriously at that time. Indigenous participation within the climate change negotiations only picked up again almost a decade later in 2001, when Indigenous peoples began regularly attending United Nations climate change negotiations, the official negotiations of the UNFCCC, and began to take a number of strong roles and active roles in those negotiations as part of wider civil society involvement. And since getting involved, I would argue that Indigenous peoples have really been pushing for two things within the climate change negotiations in particular. One is for the strongest actions and responsibilities to be taken by particularly northern states to avoid the worst impacts of climate change from having to occur. And second, to gain recognition for Indigenous peoples, Indigenous rights, and Indigenous worldviews within the climate change negotiations and framework. So in the first role, Indigenous peoples have been playing an increasingly important role in pushing for strongest possible actions by states and have actually become recognized leaders within civil society movements in the UN who are more increasingly adopting the messages of Indigenous peoples and understanding who have taken on a very crucial moral position to be one of the sort of strongest advocates against climate change. And have really joined forces in the past number of years with women's groups, with farmers, youth groups, trade groups, and a number of more progressive environmental justice groups to really form a really strong, really formidable coalition of civil society groups around the world. In the second role, Indigenous groups have also become advocates for redefining what climate change is, and it's less visible, but it's got a very important a role. Because climate change, when it was first brought under the United Nations system, was identified as a very sort of technical, very sort of even more economic issue than it's understood today. And that was how the United Nations chose to deal with it from the outset and issue things like carbon credits and sort of tax schemes. But with the involvement of Indigenous peoples and a lot of other civil society groups, it's become much more recognized, of course, as a human rights issue to this day, and of course, as a very serious political and moral issue. And what that's actually sort of meant is that a lot of the Indigenous, the rights of Indigenous peoples' language has actually been implemented in some of the United Nations negotiations. Not enough, any of us would argue, but it's starting to become recognized. And that's, an incredible precedent and, has been recognized as a precedent by a lot of other groups who are seeking to, protect their own human rights as well within the purvey of these climate change negotiations. And a lot of this work has come because of the forming of alliances with a number of more progressive states. Bolivia, of course, being one of the strongest examples, but also a number of other Latin American, African, and Asian states have actually stepped up to the plate, who were traditionally much more sort of, not supportive of Indigenous rights in the past. At the same time, Indigenous groups have become increasingly critical of the United Nations process as they've seen it go down in flames, epitomized by the Copenhagen Climate Summit and the Copenhagen Accord. And so, of course, before the Copenhagen Summit, there was an Indigenous gathering in Alaska, in Anchorage, in 2009 that brought together a lot of the world's Indigenous peoples to sort of come together and try and come up with joint positions that they could sort of take into Copenhagen, that they could take in advance beyond those meetings. And when a lot of that fell through, there was a widespread sort of rejection of the United Nations system as perhaps the body that was going to lead these kind of things. Bolivia was taken was given a strong role in organizing the Cochabamba Climate Summit in 2010, which brought together about 30,000 indigenous peoples, primarily from the Andean regions of South America. And I think both of those meetings were really instructive because they identified very similar root causes of climate change and analysis of, you know, what actual solutions would be. At the same time, it was becoming clear that indigenous peoples or somebody had to speak up about some of the solutions that were actually being proposed within the United Nations systems to climate change, as they were identified as having, you know, potentially really negative results, not just on indigenous peoples, but on the planet as a whole. A prime concern has been a focus on carbon credits by the United Nations system, which has been seen as a way for companies to basically continue to pollute, implementing, at best, ineffective, you know, methods of mitigating their you know, pollution other places in the world. At worst, coming up with really destructive plans that they push and implement on other countries and other cultures. And some of these that we've actually seen go through and that are having, you know, negative impacts on indigenous peoples to this day include mega dams that have been pushed on different populations and have forced different communities to be displaced entirely. Renewables, you know, so-called renewables being, other renewables being imposed on other communities. A variety of forest-related protection schemes that have sometimes criminalized or displaced indigenous peoples from the forests in which they live and depend upon. Nuclear power and clean coal being very heavily advocated for, of course, by industries and a number of different governments who are, you know, keen to not actually take any action on climate change. You have the really crazy ones being proposed, and you know, some of these have actually companies are starting to test these out in small scales, where they're actually trying to seed and create algae blooms in the ocean, for example, or seed the skies with different chemicals to create cloud cover and you know, reflect some of the light. We've also seen the widespread pushing and development of biofuels, palm plantations, other monocrop plantations, particularly across the global south, and, you know, impacting on a lot of indigenous territories in their kind of implementation. And so instead, you know, what indigenous communities have been saying is that, you know, these are all false solutions. These are all false paths on which, you know, we can't really rely. And the worst excesses of climate change can only be avoided if we radically reorient our society, begin to decolonize, you know, our minds, our politics, our institutions, and work to renew and revitalize relationships with Mother Earth and with each other as human beings. And I think looking at, you know, some of the examples, you know, going back from Bagua in the Amazon and a number of other indigenous communities all over the Amazon to this day, to Alberta, looking at the examples in British Columbia amongst different First Nations that are opposing the Enbridge pipeline and a number of other pipelines that are going out there, to across the United States right now, we see that indigenous nations are again retaking a front and center space in the public and leading in a lot of ways a role for to stand up and defend Mother Earth. And I think we're at a really powerful moment at this current time. In Canada, we've seen a lot of really strong actions over the past number of years that Indigenous communities have been doing to stand up and defend Mother Earth. I know that's true in the United States as well. And much more recently with, you know, the concern over the expansion of the tar sands gaining a lot of traction within Canada, within the United States, within even in international circles. We also had the culmination of a concern in Canada, at least with the Idle No More movement. I don't know how many people are familiar with that one, but began basically in December with a series of, you know, what were meant to be educational events that ended up inspiring tens of thousands of Native people in Canada to sort of organize and get active, and many youth to get involved and active, often for the first time. In their own communities. And that actually inspired, and there's pictures later from what was called the Nishiu Walkers, one of the many offsets of the I Don't Know More movement, which inspired a group of youth from northern Quebec to walk about 1,000 miles over a period of 60 days in the wintertime, about minus 30 degree temperatures. It's same Fahrenheit to Celsius, to arrive in Ottawa, where they were snubbed by our prime minister, who chose instead to do a photo op with a bunch of pandas. Anyway, it's really represented a really strong resurgence of indigenous movements, of indigenous peoples getting together, you know, also across the borders, as a lot of indigenous communities in the United States as well have come together and have started coming together to try and stop the expansion of Keystone XL pipelines and a number of other destructive projects throughout the U.S. And I think, you know, what's really what also really has to be kept in mind around, you know, particularly the opposition to the Keystone XL pipelines, in the past few weeks we've seen a lot of more media coverage than ever before around some of these other pipelines that have been spilling all across the United States and Canada. And, you know, what's really important to keep in mind, especially with the Keystone XL, is even if these pipelines work perfectly, even if there's never, you know, anything that goes wrong with them, they should still be unacceptable. They should still be recognized for continuing, you know, to commit these environmental crimes against indigenous communities, in this case in Alberta, and, you know, with the export of this oil, with the protection of this oil, you know, the continuation of climate change, you know, impacts to indigenous communities and other communities across this planet. So I want to close by sort of really noting that, you know, it's really powerful, really interesting time, you know, to be here, to be talking about these issues, to see a lot of not just Native nations come together with each other and support and really stand together, but also a lot of non-Native groups also coming in and waking up to a lot of the responsibilities that they have as well. And it's powerful to note, I think, that we're starting to recognize this, you know, not just as an environmental, not just as a very technical issue, but as a very profound political, moral, economic, and human rights issue that impacts us all, that we're all, you know, in many ways complicit, implicit, and involved within, and that it's one of those issues that will come to really define our time, perhaps even our species in the future. Some of my photos in there are part of a photo documentary series that's been produced by a group that's actually based here in California and as well as in Peru, called Conversations with the Earth, I think I have their website eventually as well. But the, you know, it's one example of one of the projects that we've done is gone across to a number of different indigenous communities around the planet and actually try and document, you know, just how indigenous communities are being impacted in that specific case by climate change. And we've had a tremendous level of support. That one actually was featured in the Smithsonian for a number of months. Has gone on tour in different parts of the United States, a little bit in South America as well. But I think as part of a more broader trend, it really represents as well a, you know, really burgeoning time where we're starting to realize and recognize the power and the importance of allowing indigenous communities to, you know, almost in many cases for the first time, speak for themselves. And that's a lot of that's come from, you know, a lot of training, a lot of education, that a lot of our young people have been, you know, getting access to over the past number of years. You know, I consider myself very lucky in that regard. You know, though not formally trained as a photographer, I've, you know, kind of fell into that role through my participation with a number of these different organizations and you know, working with a number of these different communities over the past years, that, you know, I sort of accepted and took that on as a, you know, responsibility myself. But, you know, starting to see that, you know, our people are starting to train themselves in media, in social media and communications. We have a lot of really amazing, really talented indigenous photographers as well as filmmakers these days who are, you know, doing their best to actually work and really tell our stories. And I think that is something that we definitely really have to be focused on, as well as looking at, you know, the sort of dichotomy of you know, the media, the mainstream media and the alternative media. I think we, you know, it's been really useful that a lot of our peoples have been expanding into, you know, the realms of alternative media. We have our own blogs, we have our own websites, we, you know, publish our own. There's Indian Country Today does a really, you know, powerful service for that. where we're able to get a lot of our own stories out in a lot of, in our own words. And at the same time, there's been a lot of work done to sensitize, to sensibilize the, you know, mainstream media on Native issues. Of course, you know, it's nowhere near where it needs to be. You know, I think they still don't take a lot of our issues very seriously, or, you know, look at them in a very in-depth way, as many of us would like them to. But I think that's you know, that along with the role of education, starting in schools, you know, making sure that kind of thing reaches out, that, you know, children have an actual decent education, decent understanding of, you know, who Native people are, that, you know, we still exist. We didn't just, you know, disappear in the 1800s walk into the sunset and say, hey, that was great, you know, have the country now. We're just gonna disappear. But understanding, you know, the actual current lived experiences and history of Native people, I think all those little things are definitely necessary pieces to really construct a more representative media experience, a more representative, you know, public experience, public sort of profile of Indigenous peoples that will actually allow us to understand and empathize with, you know, Indigenous experiences here, not just in North America, but of course with, you know, Indigenous communities across the world, and, you know, other impacted peoples who are, you know, affected by the things that we do, the actions that we do, the policies and actions of our governments as well. I think that, you know, only with time, only with a lot more, you know, action on that front, are we actually going to have, you know, the ability to bring our peoples together and you know, ensure that kind of respect is in, you know, not just in the media, but, you know, in widespread society. Yeah.
Thank you so much. And obviously this is an incredibly complex set of issues, and we can't possibly go into really give it the time and attention that it needs to fully develop. I realize we're coming right up to the break time, so I want to allow students who need to go to a class to go ahead and transition. But if we could have, if anyone in the audience has a question that they are really interested in asking or posing right now, I'd like to open it up for audience questions. If anyone wants to further this conversation. John?
Thanks. Hi, Ben. John Foran. I talked to you in Durban a couple years ago.
Yeah.
That was the interview I did that got erased somehow, and I'm devastated by that. So I do have a question. And it's really asked you to update us on how you see the global climate justice movement developing, and particularly the youth component, which I've become quite impressed by.
Yeah. So I think what's been really powerful, really incredible over the past few years has been the, you know, the creation of you know, global climate justice movement, with actual strong participation of a number of U.S. groups, North American-based groups, and European groups. Has really been, I think, one of the more sort of hopeful things that we could possibly see. Of course, there's not been, you know, the necessary sort of, you know, action and follow-up here in the U.S., which is what really needs to happen. But with the rise of this sort of global climate justice movement over the past number of years, they've really taken a strong space within climate change negotiations as well as outside of climate change negotiations. To give a voice to a lot of the most impacted communities, to really try and hold a lot of states accountable and, you know, push them to take the most responsibilities possible. But they've also gone and above and beyond that in creating, you know, alternative spaces outside of just the formal negotiation spaces. And, you know, that's become really, really necessary and really often some of the most powerful spaces. If you know, you're actually at some of these United Nations negotiations, not a lot of you know, things are very possible within the negotiations themselves. You know, you can make a statement as civil society group, maybe a total of 10 times. You know, as all of civil society gets about 10 opportunities to make statements during the entire negotiations. And apart from that, you know, there's very little sort of allowed participation from, you know, representatives of all these different peoples around the world. And so I think the global climate justice movement has been really powerful in trying to bring a lot of these groups together, trying to, you know, get us to know one another. And I think that that's really formed a lot of really strong links and a lot of strong solidarity. And particularly, I do want to also mention that a number of the youth groups have been doing really powerful work in that way as well. When I first got involved in international climate change negotiations, a lot of the youth groups there were, you know, very cheerful, very sort of positive, and, you know, doing the kind of like, yeah, youth want to fight climate change, and they were very good, you know, they had very good sort of intentions and everything, but they didn't necessarily have a lot of the analysis, a lot of the understanding of you know, how complex these issues sometimes were. And, you know, especially one of the main troubles with, or the main, one of the main challenges with doing a lot of youth work is there's an incredible amount of turnover. You know, people eventually stop becoming youth somehow, which isn't necessarily true for a lot of the other sort of, you know, social movements, you know. And so there's a constant amount of work that's needed to, you know, bring people in, to get them up to speed, to educate them. And I think it's really through, you know, a lot of dedicated groups out there that we've been able to see in the past 2 years really strong youth actions within United Nations negotiations. A lot of youth have actually, you know, stood up and actually, in many cases, got themselves kicked out for taking the strong stances that they have in solidarity with indigenous groups, with island states, with African states in Durban. It's been really, really powerful to actually see that. And I think that that, in many ways alone, inspires a lot of other groups, inspires even some of the states. You know, we've actually seen some of the, you know, representatives, members of different countries come out and, you know, just be in tears, just be really touched by just how far the young people are willing to go. And I mean, you know, the range of that is very, you know, varies incredibly, but, you know, sometimes we have people as young as you know, 9, 10, 11 participating in some of these negotiations. And, you know, to hear a 10-year-old get up and give a speech, you know, there's usually not a dry eye left in the auditorium afterwards. And so there's a lot of real, you know, powerful space that I think our young people are starting to take up and, you know, demand for themselves within these negotiations. And I think that that's, you know, a trend that can only, you know, continue and get stronger.
Thank you so much. I want to allow people to have time for a quick break before our next session. So I think we should give Ben our thanks once again for his fantastic presentation. Thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.